From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The New Hampshire Lottery's been around for 5 decades, and as in many states, profits are slated for public education. It's a fact the Lottery Commission heavily promotes through its motto, "When you play, everyone wins," and with commercials showing adorable school children. But the lottery's image wasn't always so wholesome. 50 years ago, in 1964, New Hampshire engaged in a furious debate over whether to approve this new state-run game of chance. Most newspapers trounced the idea. One called it a cheap John way of raising revenues, while another worried about long-range effects on public morality. National media were watching, too, guessing that success in the Granite State would lead to imitators elsewhere. And on that score, prognosticators were right. Today, all but 7 states have some kind of lottery, but this form of gambling still has its critics, including those who call it a regressive tax on the poor. Today in The Exchange, 50 years of the New Hampshire Lottery. We'll talk with the author of a forthcoming book on the topic, and let's hear from you, too. Do you buy lottery tickets? Why or why not? If you remember some of these earlier debates over the lottery, how do you think they resonate today? Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guest is Kevin Flynn. He's an award-winning journalist, the author of 4 nonfiction books. His forthcoming book that we're talking about today is called All of King's Horses, How New Hampshire Fought the Feds, the Mob, the Church, the Media, and Itself to Start the First Lottery. Kevin Flynn, welcome back. It's great to see you.
Good to see you, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Well, you write, Kevin, that mostly about this 50-year history of New Hampshire's lottery and all that intrigue that I just mentioned, the church, the media, the mob, the feds. But you also write, Kevin, that lotteries themselves go way back, way, way back, more than 50 years. How much farther back?
Oh, into antiquity, really. I mean, for New Hampshire to, you know, say that we invented the first lottery would be like Colorado 50 years from now saying they invented marijuana. You know, it's what had occurred for many years were lotteries that were designed to raise money for public works. The Great Wall of China was funded in part by a lottery. Roman aqueducts, the British government raised a lot of money through lotteries. In fact, the Jamestown colony was financed through a lottery. So you could say the U.S. is literally the offspring of a lottery.
Wow.
And lotteries remained very popular, ubiquitous in colonial times and in the early United States right up until about the Civil War, and then vanished at the end of the 19th century. And that's where New Hampshire stood in 1963 when Governor John King signed the sweepstakes bill.
Well, and hence that's the title, All of King's Men. But talk about some of those earlier ones, Kevin, please. You know, the aqueducts, the Great Wall of China, Jamestown, whatever. I mean, how did those lotteries work? I can't imagine that they had, you know, TV commercials for Powerball.
No, they all worked in sort of different ways, but were very similar to a modern raffle where there were tickets sold and they would draw a winner. Keno goes back to the Han Dynasty of China.
Really?
Where they called it the White Pigeon Game. It was because they would use these homing pigeons to spread the word of what the number was to different villages. And it was seen then, as it is really today, as a popular way of financing public works without having to raise taxes. And that's where that came from. Most of them were drawing lots goes back to biblical times. Moses was told to divide the land of Canaan by lots. The 12th apostle after Judas Iscariot, left, was again drawn by lots. It was thought to be the divine will of God would decide, and this was the indication of what God thought, because it was heads or tails or whatever. So the idea of casting one's lot, of course, comes from that term. And, you know, the organized lottery came into sort of the Midlands of Europe right around the medieval ages. Many countries started to form their own lotteries, the Dutch, the Italians. The Italian lottery was a really big deal. The princes of the region would often be the sponsors. More often than not, these games were not on the level that sometimes the sponsor would miraculously win the grand prize, and it still remained a popular way for the people in the lower classes in order to get a leg up
and fund public works at the same time.
Exactly.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned, the princes in Italy and how sometimes the sponsor of the lottery would miraculously win. So these games are not always on the up and up. That's what turned people off in this country, right, Kevin, to lotteries, say 100 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, eventually, during colonial times, lotteries were still very important. The way they would work would be that the colonial government of one of the colonies would sanction a lottery. Now, the colony or the state would not run the lottery itself. They basically gave a license to a third-party businessman who could say, I can run this lottery on your behalf, and the money would go to the hospital or to the general fund or whatever. And these third-party people who were called brokers would go around to different parts of the colony or go into other colonies, hang out in taverns and other places, and sell lottery tickets. In fact, some of the lottery tickets were at a price point where the average commoner could not afford it. So the broker would break up the ticket into smaller parts. This is where some of the first stock brokers came from, people invested in the ticket, and the broker would give eight different people, eight shares in that one ticket.
Hence the word broker. You're breaking the ticket?
Yes. I can't remember chicken egg on that, but that was a term that they used. And in colonial times, these lotteries helped to fund things such as buildings at Harvard, at Yale, at Dartmouth. Multiple times Dartmouth held lotteries. Things like the renovation of the U.S. Capitol was funded by a national lottery. During the Revolutionary War, part of the idea of funding the revolution, as people know, the colonists tried to print their own money, which was virtually worthless. They got financial aid from allies like France and Spain. And the third thing they did is they tried to run a national lottery to raise $10 million for the Continental Army. Now, they fell short, but again, this sort of goes to explain why in the no taxation without representation area, how they could raise funds. And it wasn't until sort of the early 1900s in which the states were at the position where they could tax and they could bond finally, because the economy had sort of settled into that way, that lotteries were reserved for special things such as libraries or covered bridges. Virtually all the early covered bridges in New Hampshire were paid for by lotteries. And they started to fall out of fashion because some of them were very corrupt. As a matter of fact, I mentioned that lottery about renovating the U.S. Capitol sort of around 1830 or so. The broker for that lottery, when it came time to do the draw, which was about $2 million, absconded with all the money and just vanished. And so
you could do that in those days.
Apparently, to never be found again was a pretty neat trick. And so the winner sued, and the case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court said the state was responsible for those winnings. So many of the states kind of said, maybe this isn't just sort of a courtesy we're doing. We are financially responsible. Other things occurred. A lot of state constitutions were amended to ban lotteries. But the real thing that ended the lottery in the United States was the Louisiana lottery. The Louisiana Lottery was, again, not run by Louisiana, but by a third party, the Louisiana Lottery Company.
Who said, I will do this for you, Louisiana. You'll get some of the proceeds. It'll be all
It'll
good.
Go to this charitable hospital, and it was really great. And it expanded throughout the United States. It was in every from Maine to California. They called it the golden octopus because it was so big and it just could not be controlled. If you went to New Orleans at this time, 1880s, 1890s, there was a lottery bowery where there were people that were children were begging for money, and there were, veterans and pensioners that were asking for money. It's like to buy lottery tickets. It was a big deal when they would draw the number. There was a big show where they had these Confederate generals come out and make these speeches, and they would have two large barrels, and they would pull a name out of one and a prize out of the other, match the two, and that was the lottery. And they were so corrupt that they were buying politicians, and there was really no way for the state to extract itself. It took President Benjamin Harrison to go to Congress and say, we have to end the scourge of lotteries. So what they did is they established laws with the postal code, which said you can't use the mails for lotteries, and that sort of strangled their ability to get and sell tickets all over the country. Half of the mail that went to New Orleans at that time was for the lottery.
Wow. Yeah. So Louisiana had this amazing lottery. Everybody in the country, the very young country still at that point, wanted to participate. So finally the feds clamped down using the good old U.S. mail.
Yeah, this was 1890, and there were a couple of laws like that, 1890, 1895. And these were the federal laws that were on the books when New Hampshire set off with establishing the New Hampshire sweepstakes.
Which, again, celebrates a 50th birthday this week. And we're going to look at that very interesting history, Kevin, after a short break, of how this came to New Hampshire, how New Hampshire got around some of this federal uncertainty that you mentioned. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. If you remember some of the earlier debates here in the Granite State over the lottery, how do you think they resonate today? Also, do you buy lottery tickets? Tell us why or why not. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More with Kevin Flynn in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, 50 years of the New Hampshire lottery. We're talking with Kevin Flynn, author of a forthcoming book on this first-in-the-nation state-run lottery. It's called All of King's Horses. Kevin's also co-author of several other books with his wife, Rebecca Lavoie, who also happens to be NHPR's digital director. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions and comments about how the lottery got started here in New Hampshire 50 years ago, how other states quickly imitated what the Granite State was doing, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, Kevin, you laid out a great presentation of just how lotteries have always been with us, always have funded public works projects. Then in the late 1800s, the feds cracked down. They say it's gotten too corrupt. And that's kind of where we're at until the early 1960s here in New Hampshire. So put us there. When did people here in New Hampshire start thinking, we kind of could use a lottery. Let's see what we can do.
After World War II, there were a couple of state representatives that put through lottery bills, but they never went anywhere. They all died in committee. And in 1955, there was a representative from Keene named Lawrence Pickett. Larry Pickett had been mayor of Keene, and at one point he likes to just tell the story of this little old lady who came into his office and couldn't afford the $100 increase in property taxes. And he came up with this idea of a $50 sweepstakes window at the racetrack. It wasn't until 1955, and he sort of picked his moment at the end of the session when nobody was really paying attention to introduce an amendment to a school funding bill to establish a sweepstakes. Now, what's important to note is what a sweepstakes is and how it's different from a lottery and how New Hampshire's first lottery was very different than it is today.
It's based on horse racing.
Yeah, it wasn't a ticket, a scratch ticket. It wasn't a numbers pull. It was a horse race, and it was based on the Irish sweepstakes, which had been very popular and also very illegal in the U.S. But it was an event. It meant that people would buy a ticket, and then their name would be drawn, and they would draw the name of a thoroughbred racehorse. And if that horse ran in the race and won, then that player won the grand prize. So it was very interesting. Pickett introduced the bill 5 different times over 10 years. At one point, it had been it passed in the House and Senate, and that Governor Lane Dwindle, a Republican, said on Friday that he would sign it. And on Monday, he said that he decided to veto it because he got a call from Sherman Adams, former New Hampshire governor, President Eisenhower's chief of staff, who told him Ike didn't want this. It would be bad for the Republicans. And Dwindle came out and said, I'm wrong. I made a mistake. I'm going to veto the bill. It wasn't until finally 1963 when we had an influx for the first time in decades of Democrats, a Democrat in the governor's seat, John King, a large number of Democrats in the House, that this bipartisan bill for a sweepstakes finally passed, and then we were off and running.
Well, and I want to ask you definitely, Kevin, in a moment about the federal government's concerns about this, from Eisenhower to Kennedy. But let's take some calls if we could. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's an email from Lori, who says, "We crow about the billions that go to education, but never mention the gross or how much goes to the mafia. Any figures there?" Lori, thanks for the email. Kevin, talk about where the money goes. I don't think the mafia gets any money.
No. And as far as I can tell, that number is zero. However, that was one of the biggest concerns of 1963, 1964. That was one of the major arguments against the lottery, that our poor, bucolic state would be overrun by the mob, and that racketeering would take hold of the lottery, because it always had.
So Lori's right in a historical sense.
In a historical sense, yes. The last time the New Hampshire residents amended our state constitution, which was 1990, it was to say that all of the money raised by the New Hampshire lottery goes to education, so that couldn't be rated in the general fund. But that was, you know, very interesting. You also have to remember that at the same time, you know, we had the sweepstakes was coming online, people were gambling, and they were buying. They were running. There was number runners, and so that was controlled by the mob. You could play your 3-digit number. You could play it every day. If you didn't have the money, the bookies would give you credit, and you could call that number in. And it was difficult to clamp down on that. Again, most of those games were fixed. The mobsters knew day to day which numbers were the fancy numbers. And when they would do their draw, they would do things like mark the numbers, or they would freeze them so that the guy picking it would know not to go for that number. And they worked it out, because if they had more than a couple of winners, they could, you know, bankrupt the policy bank for that day. So, yeah, that was it. One of the major stated concerns about the sweepstakes was that, absolutely, the underworld had always influenced and always infiltrated gambling schemes, and this would definitely happen in New Hampshire.
Thanks for the email, Lori. Again, the email address is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, the phone number, 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at 50 years of the New Hampshire lottery and some of the fascinating history surrounding it. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Again, the email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, too, if you'd like. So, Kevin, the federal government, Eisenhower, and especially JFK and his brother, Robert Kennedy, the attorney general, they were very concerned about the lottery and put a lot of pressure on New Hampshire not to do this.
Yeah, in addition to those mail regulations that had been around for about 70 years, RFK, as you know, was a big organized crime dragon slayer, and he would go after Jimmy Hoffa and whatnot. So two of the laws that his Department of Justice was able to get Congress to pass were the Wire Act and the Interstate – I'm going to get the name wrong – the Interstate Gambling Paraphernalia Transportation Act. Basically what it meant is that you couldn't use telephones to pass along illegal gambling information, and that you couldn't take gambling paraphernalia like tickets and other records across state lines. They made that a federal fence.
Wow. So you live in Boston, you go to Lake Winnipesaukee, you buy a New Hampshire lottery ticket, you can't bring it back to Boston.
That ended up being the problem. That wasn't the intention of the law, but that law was on the books and complicated it. So yes, they basically conceded the lottery could exist within the boundary of New Hampshire.
You can do what you want, New Hampshire.
But if one were to take a ticket out of New Hampshire and crossing that state line, that ticket holder could be charged with a federal crime. And so New Hampshire had to come up with a creative way of dealing with that and keeping the lottery commercially interesting. And in the end, the New Hampshire sweepstakes became not only a national sensation but a national scandal. And that's what makes the story of its birthday 50 years ago so compelling.
So how did New Hampshire officials get around that, you know, all the tourists who come here and wanted to buy lottery tickets? And you're right, Kevin, they sure did. They love this. How did they get around that interstate prohibition that the Kennedy administration put out?
A very clever way, which may have been splitting hairs, but this is how they did it. If one were to buy a sweepstakes ticket, they could only buy them, first of all, in a New Hampshire liquor store at one of the racetracks. And there was actually a statewide referendum where every town voted on whether or not tickets could be sold in their community. And only six of the 200-plus towns in New Hampshire said no. None of them had lottery tickets, so the point was moot. But you'd go and you'd buy a ticket, and it was an electronic machine, and a little window would open, and the player would have to write their name and their address, and then they'd pull a lever, and a carbon copy of that ticket would come out. The ticket itself stayed in New Hampshire. Now, the carbon copy, they called it an acknowledgement, not a receipt. They basically said, this ticket has no value. You could tear it up. You don't have to present it in order to get your prize. So they said, that ticket has no value. You could take it across state lines, and it wouldn't be a problem. That was New Hampshire's position. The feds, there was, depending on whom you spoke to, the FBI or a U.S. attorney in this state or that state, they took different positions. And there were people in the 1960s who were arrested with New Hampshire lottery tickets. In fact, one state, one fella, his case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Wow. Where was he from?
He was from New York. His name was Anthony Fabrizio. And he had purchased 75 tickets from the lottery from the liquor store in Keene.
75 tickets? Wow,
well,
that's a lot.
Well, you know, there were some people that would come and buy one ticket. They were $3 a piece. Remember, it was the only place you could get it was New Hampshire. So some people would go buy for friends. Some people started to make a little bit of a living off of it. They're trying to say, for 50 cents, I'm going to get a ticket. It ended up being that the feds, the legal memo that went out to from the Department of Justice was try to avoid bugging the tourist who comes through and buys a couple of tickets, and don't go arresting them. Look for people who are essentially acting as bookies, trying to make a business out of buying large quantities. They arrested this guy, Fabrizio, in New York. The federal judge in New York threw out the case, but the Department of Justice appealed. And it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And there's a wonderful moment. I listened to the tape of the oral arguments. And New Hampshire filed as a friend of the court, an amicus brief, and wanted to be heard. And the New Hampshire Lottery's counsel was Joseph Millamit, and a lot of people familiar with the name Millamit in legal circles today. He was the counsel and got to argue in front of the Supreme Court. And Chief Justice Warren, when listening to Millamit talk about New Hampshire's position on these acknowledgments, the Chief Justice said, "So why do you give these acknowledgments if they're not worth anything?" And there's this long pause. And Millamit, this has got to be the biggest moment of his legal career. Here's the Chief Justice of the United States. He pauses and he says, "Mr. Chief Justice, that is an excellent question." And just everybody cracks up. And Warren says, "Well, I thought it is, because that's why." And he said, people have to have something. It's a souvenir. It doesn't
– A souvenir.
Yeah. When they pay, they want to feel like they have something. Ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled against Fabrizio and by extension New Hampshire and said you cannot take the tickets across state lines. It didn't kill the sweepstakes. It did make selling sweepstakes tickets harder. And in the last half of the 60s, the popularity of the sweepstakes horse race declined.
Because only in-staters could do it.
Well, no, out-of-staters could still do it. They could still buy tickets. It didn't really matter what the Supreme Court said, you know.
Who cares about that?
Yeah, you know, that it didn't. New Hampshire didn't have to take any, extra precautions of selling to out-of-staters because, what they did with that acknowledgement was their own business. They didn't have to keep it. They didn't have to bring it home. They could tear it up if they wanted to. But that was sort of the beginning of the end for the sweepstakes. And New Hampshire and a couple of other states, following New Hampshire's lead, started doing their own lotteries, which were scratch tickets and raffle tickets. And this is where New Hampshire gets into the sort of what is, today's lottery business, where there are instant tickets, where we start to do a daily numbers game. And eventually we are where we are here. It's no longer the sexy horse race anymore because the bloom kind of fell off that rose. But that story really interested me because very few people remember that this was a horse race and that there was all this opposition from the post office department, the FCC. If you and I in 1964 were doing this interview now, we would be fined $1,000 and could face a year in prison.
Why?
Because we are talking about – because broadcasting is a form of interstate commerce. There are – to this day, as you may know, there are still in the FCC rules against radio stations doing their own lotteries, which means you pay for a chance to win. That's the distinction. You don't just get a chance. If you have to pay for the chance to win, that is a lottery. And so – it took until about 1975 for Congress to carve out exceptions to all these existing gambling rules that allowed for state-sponsored lotteries to sort of operate without interference.
Well, and today, Kevin, as you write, only 7 states don't have a lottery. And maybe a little bit later on, I'll ask you about those states and why that's the case. We invite your questions and comments again, 1-800-892-6477. If you have questions about this history of the New Hampshire lottery, it turns 50 years old this year. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. If you buy a lottery ticket or not, if you remember some of this early history that Kevin Flynn talks about, you can join us again. It's 1-800-892-6477. Now, Kevin, here's an email that came in from Doug in Portsmouth. Now, this is long, but he's remembering some of this early history. So bear with me because this is interesting. He says, the reason for this email is a conversation I had about 15 years ago with the Reverend Johnny Papandrew, the Unitarian minister at Portsmouth South Church at the time the lottery was created. So he's remembering some of this history that you write about. Johnny said he, along with other clergy, were going to Concord to weigh in on the lottery discussion before the vote. He said there was a lot of disagreement and controversy, and there was a very real expectation that New Hampshire clergy would probably play a big and probably deciding role in whether the lottery would pass or not. He was a close friend and fellow Seacoast clergyman Rabbi Aaron Golden of Portsmouth Temple Israel drove to Concord. And all throughout the trip, they went over their strategy for discussion on the matter. They were expecting to be part of the larger voice of opposition to the lottery idea. He said he himself had been a bit undecided, but that Rabbi Golden had encouraged him to speak out. And all along the way, the rabbi helped him strengthen his argument. When they arrived, they were prepared to strike down the idea. But when they did arrive and heard some of the other deliberations, particularly the adamant opposition coming from the state's Roman Catholic clergy, they immediately began to change their entire perspective. It sounded to them like the Catholic Church was trying to protect their monopoly on gambling as a major fundraising source. After hearing that, he and Rabbi Golden decided to argue in favor of acceptance. He said that when Rabbi Golden got up to speak, he was the most articulate and eloquent supporter of the lottery he ever heard. Again, this is a story from a friend of Reverend Johnny Papandrew, the UU minister in Portsmouth. So, wow, there you have some clergy involvement and kind of playing it both ways.
Absolutely. The clergy very early on did play a significant role, especially in those 10 years prior to the bill being passed. The clergy were the ones that were the loudest voices at House and Senate hearings. They brought petitions. It wasn't until 62 during those hearings when they were greatly outnumbered. sort of what you might consider the voice of the people were to be heard. Governor John King, who was the first Catholic governor of New Hampshire.
Oh, really?
He was the first Democrat in 40 years, met with a lot of the Protestant clergy. He was very polite. And for 2 weeks after the bill passed the House and Senate, King locked himself in his office in a real sort of monastic seclusion.
Really? 2 weeks? That wouldn't be tolerated today.
Yes.
2 weeks.
And he actually did not know how he would – if he would sign the bill. Now, he had – as a member of the House, he voted twice for it. But now the stakes are different. He's governor. He wants to be
reelected. This is his legacy.
Yeah. Does he – he's like, do I sign this bill or not? Because, this is – if it fails – then I will not be reelected. It's already very tenuous that I'm here. And one of the things that he did, which bolstered his ability to sign the bill, was that he got support from, of all people, Bill Loeb of the union leader.
Supporting a Democratic governor.
Well, this is why. I mean, all of the other newspapers in New Hampshire and virtually all the publications in the U.S. that had an editorial writer wrote against the sweepstakes for all the same reasons. It was morally wrong. It would invite corruption. The left-leaning newspapers were saying we need to reform our tax code. The right-leaning newspapers were saying we have a moral obligation. But Bill Loeb had a very different position. And it was because he thought this would lead to a sales tax if there were no sweepstakes. So he became the biggest advocate of the sweepstakes, swung a lot of votes, got it passed.
More on Bill Loeb, John King, and some of the other characters involved in the early history of New Hampshire's lottery. More in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're getting the backstory of the New Hampshire lottery and looking back 50 years since it began, starting a new era, not just in New Hampshire, but nationwide. Whether that's for good or for ill is a matter of opinion, but we're learning about how it all got started with author Kevin Flynn. His forthcoming book is called All of King's Horses, How New Hampshire Fought the Feds, the Mob, the Church, the Media, and itself to start the first lottery. You can join us with your questions and comments. If you buy a lottery ticket or not, tell us why or why not. Also, if you remember some of this early history that we're talking about, we'd love to hear from you. We got a great email earlier from someone on the seacoast who had a good historical take on this. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Kevin, let's go to Sanborn and Richard's on the air. Hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I can remember back in the day that in the 70s, the New Hampshire Highway Hotel, they used to hold a big drawing down there every year. I mean, the hotel's not there anymore, but it was, that hotel was quite significant in drawings and stuff.
You know, Richard, thanks for calling. From what I've heard from longtime lawmakers, the Highway Hotel was famous for all sorts of stuff, including some great politicking where Republicans and Democrats would get together. But talk about the Highway Hotel, if you could, Kevin.
Well, this seems to be where the big drawings took place after the inaugural year. And I thank Richard for the call. In the inaugural year, 1964, what they did is they would take the tickets, and for every $1 million worth of tickets, they would do another draw. And they held these at Rockingham Park and made a big press event out of it. It was very public. And again, what would happen is that person would draw a name from a giant plexiglass drum, and then someone would draw the name of a horse, and they would be matched. And there were more than 300 horses nominated for the race, which is pretty typical. They anticipated maybe a dozen would actually enter and run, including the Kentucky Derby winner and all this other stuff. So they would do that. And then when there was another $1 million in tickets, they would do the same thing. So by the time they were done in the first year, they had sold more than 6 million tickets. So there were basically six people for each one of the horses. So the grand prize winner and that horse won, six other people won. The grand prize was $100,000.
That's a lot for the 60s, huh?
It is. Adjusted for inflation, it's about not three quarters of a million dollars. That doesn't make sense. Actually, it is. Yeah, about three quarters of a million dollars.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure that person was thrilled, and that probably blew up publicity for the lottery, right? Or
yeah, well, the publicity had sort of been – was building immediately because of the unique nature and because of all the sort of – the specters of evil that the sweepstakes would bring, which is interesting for – it was an event that was just going to be held once a year the first year and then twice a year thereafter. And so there were definitely concerns. I mean, some of the – I'll just for sake of disclosure, the reason I got interested in this story was several years ago. I worked for an ad and PR agency, and one of our clients was the lottery. I'm not a state employee, but we gave advice, and the 45th anniversary was coming around, and you know, we were looking at ways to promote it. And this was also when expanded gaming was really hot in the news, and there was talk, well, the lottery should take that over. And I was surprised to find that the lottery had a large archive of their original press clippings. And so I started going through that, and two things popped out. One was that a lot of the language used to describe the possible effects of the sweepstakes were very similar to what people were saying about casino gambling, that it was going to affect the character of the state and whatnot. And also was just sort of the arc of this narrative about how the federal government, the Justice Department, the Post Office Department, the FCC was against it, how the mob was going to take over. And I said, nobody remembers this. And I was just – I fell in love with this story. I said, one of these days I have to do it, and that's why I've been writing it.
Yeah, well, and some of the press from that era – I mean, here's the Summersworth Free Press. The work of a generation has gone into building an image for this state, of a place where families can enjoy natural beauties of our outdoors, where industry can come and grow in healthy economic climate, where young people can live and find opportunity for growth of their interests, where our aged citizens can retire and live in quiet peace and mind. Now, almost overnight, all that is to be wiped out. That's the Summersworth Free Press in 1964. The Derry Star said the devil himself would find audience here if he had cash in hand and a gimmick to exploit. Parade Magazine, nationally, people were chiming in on this. Gambling attracts the worst in transient and frequently brings out the worst in people. Granite State News worried about the long-range effects on public morality. And here's the Argus champion in 1964. Every other state will have its own lottery, and New Hampshire will be left all by itself to freeze on the vine. So in general, it seems like almost every newspaper in the state, as you said, Kevin, and every newspaper around the country hated this idea. Here's the union leader saying, no, this is a good idea. It's a way to raise money without raising taxes. And that kind of helped Governor King make his decision, didn't it?
Yeah, interesting thing about Bill Loeb is it's sort of the legacy people think was that that Loeb was against Democrats and he would beat up on Democrats. But for the first 15 years he owned the union leader, Democrats were not political players in New Hampshire. Basically, he was going after other Republicans. I think today you would probably consider Loeb a Tea Party Republican because he was very much about an ideology. And so for moderate Republicans that didn't fit into that, he was brutal. And so the reason why the sweepstakes appealed to him was because he saw it as one, a way to prevent a sales tax from being implemented. And two, he saw it as a voluntary tax. He said that people, you know, don't have to buy alcohol. They don't have to buy cigarettes. They don't have to gamble. We had pari-mutuel gambling. Those were all three sin taxes that New Hampshire had. He said, if you don't have the sweepstakes, then what's that money going – where's that money going to come from? From some involuntary tax. And so he saw it as a way to keep taxes down.
And the money does go to education. Some of it obviously to overhead, though. I mean, it costs money to run these things. Do you know just what the rough breakdown is, Kevin, of, you know, how much goes to overhead, how much goes to education?
Today or
so
back
forth?
In
today?
I'm not positive. I believe sales figures for the New Hampshire lottery are between $70 and $80 million. They're, you know, obviously money goes for prizes.
Yeah, you got to pay out to the people who win.
Yeah, right. There's a little bit of overhead. I think it's like 1 or 2%. It's not very much. But the remainder goes into the education trust fund, and people, communities can do with it, you know. It all goes to education, but at the time they could have used it to either up their education budget or reduce their property taxes. And it, depending on the community, they did that.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions and comments about the history of the New Hampshire Lottery, which turns 50 this year. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well if you like, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Kevin, we mentioned that one of the concerns by newspapers in other states, by the federal government, was that if New Hampshire does this thing and is successful, it'll take off. Boy, they were right. Today, I think only seven states don't have a lottery. Why don't those seven states have a lottery? It almost seems like, you know, who are these people?
Not quite certain about what why the other seven states have not got on the bandwagon. I think one of them is actually Nevada. The last state, I believe, to come on board was in Arkansas. And, you know, it's the thing that, you know, I always think about here with New Hampshire, with this experiment, is that if New Hampshire had failed and all these other obstacles got in the way and New Hampshire didn't succeed and none of the other states followed, how different would American culture be today? Lotteries are ubiquitous. You cannot go into a gas station or a supermarket without being a place to purchase a lottery ticket. It's what makes people dream. And you can say lotteries are good or bad, and you know, there are strong arguments on both sides. You could say New Hampshire opened Pandora's box.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, some people would say, yeah, it's too bad New Hampshire succeeded because now they're everywhere.
However, what would be the American daydream? How would people get out of their meager existence and dream about having no debt and about having the Learjet and all the other things that that people dream about? You know, the lottery mentality is part of our culture. And though in the 1960s we think of the big things like Vietnam and the British invasion the sexual revolution, below the surface was also the New Hampshire sweepstakes, slowly turning what would become today's America. And again, for good or for bad, New Hampshire was the leader here. And if it didn't work, it's hard to imagine, you know, what that American daydream would be.
Although, given how excited people were about the New Hampshire lottery and all the people that came in from out of state to buy these tickets, it makes me think, Kevin, that if New Hampshire didn't succeed, somebody else would have.
Yeah, but I think, you know, a lot of the other states would still have the same federal entanglements that New Hampshire faced. The next state to get a lottery was New York. I think it was 1967. Theirs was very much a ticket-based lottery. And then about 1968, there was a mechanical problem with the tickets. They had like a misprint on hundreds of thousands of tickets, and they had to shut the whole lottery down because the integrity of the lottery was something that was very important. And by that I mean, you know, for hundreds of years, people would place bets with lotteries, with bookies. Almost all of those games were fixed to some level. There were people who were skimming. The numbers were fixed. The big legacy of the way New Hampshire operated the sweepstakes was that nobody could argue that it wasn't on the level.
Anybody could win.
That anybody could. But the, you know, the results were not fixed. That it was a pure game of chance. There's nobody monkeying around with the numbers. The money will be paid out to real people. And, you know, that was one of the things that the executive director of the lottery insisted on. Great side story. The executive director of the first sweepstakes was Ed Powers. He was the special agent in charge of the FBI in Boston.
A squeaky clean guy.
He was like Elliot Ness. He not only solved the Brinks heist, the 1950s Brinks heist, which was the largest bank robbery in the state, in the history, he got a confession with 3 days to go before the statute of limitations ran out. He was also the only FBI agent to capture two guys on the most wanted list at the same time. So his bona fides were impeccable, and that's what he brought, a sense of gravitas to this legal gambling thing. And he also got the religion. He evangelized about, look, I'd seen illegal gambling. This is different. This is on the level the average guy can get a fair shot at winning this.
Yeah, and that's fascinating. And, you know, we talked a minute ago, Kevin, about how New Hampshire did succeed with this and everybody sort of followed our lead. I'm wondering if that's a big reason behind the success in those very early years, is that Governor King convinced this squeaky clean FBI guy to run this. I mean, it's amazing that he agreed to do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he liked the challenge. You know, he had been with the FBI for 20 years. And, yeah, he really was the most celebrated FBI agent of his time. He was one of Hoover's favorites because of what he had done. So I think that was the big win, actually, for the sweepstakes, was getting powers. And he remained after he left the New Hampshire sweepstakes in the early 70s, he was a consultant to other state lotteries, helped form what is the industry organization that oversees and advocates on behalf of the lotteries, considered the grandfather of the modern American lottery.
And again, gave it a clean image here in the Grand State.
Everybody who knew him, you know, just nice guy, just was Superman. He just had so much charisma. He sold the sweepstakes. One of the things, you know, that could have stopped the lottery was this statewide referendum. This legislature had passed it, but part of the bill was there will be a referendum in March, same day as the presidential primary. And every town can vote on just a simple question: should tickets be sold in our state? And if they said no, no tickets could be sold there. You know, imagine if Salem had said no. I mean, the biggest liquor store by volume and the racetrack. I mean, big monkey wrench. What Powers did is he went on a charm offensive and talked to every Kiwanis Club, every Chamber of Commerce, every JC's Club, and made an appearance and one by one got people on board. And in the end, that referendum, which was, everything was hanging in the balance here, it passed in New Hampshire by almost 4-1.
Really? Despite all the opposition, you know, by the newspapers and some members of the clergy and controversy in the legislature, people
said,
The average guy liked it.
Yep, the average guy wanted it.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And the average guy felt like he or she had a chance to win because this guy had powers, again, was going to keep it clean. But what are the chances, Kevin, that someone does win the lottery? I mean, we always hear these sort of, you know, you're more likely to be struck by lightning or, you know,
yeah, but
who knows what.
There's no second place for getting struck by lightning.
True,
you know,
enough.
I mean, the odds are long, obviously. Anybody who plays thinking they're going to win is you know, fooling themselves. People play, despite the fact, they know what the odds are.
Do they?
Absolutely. Most of the people who know that the odds are totally, you know, incredible. But the reason a lot of people play is because it's a form of entertainment, that they're buying a dream for a buck or for $5. I'm the historian. I'm not the social scientist. You know, I can't really say why, but that is why people play. Now, there are people who, you know, play too much, spend too much on lottery tickets, the same way other people spend too much on alcohol, too much on cigarettes, too much on shopping. You know, we should never be surprised that people with compulsive personalities act compulsively. However, I think the average guy plays the lottery because they want that one shot at the dream. They're not investing in their 401k here. This isn't their retirement plan. Most people like to, you know, scratch the ticket, have a minute of fun. Maybe they win. More often than not, they don't.
What's been the biggest wow moment for you, Kevin, working on this book?
My favorite story is that when they finally did the big drawing, the wife of one of the leading opponents won. She was assigned with a horse. And the headline in the, I think it was the Concord Daily Monitor, was "This House Divided." And there's going to be a lot of explaining to do over the kitchen table. I just think that's one of the great stories.
So one of the leading state lawmakers against the lottery, his wife was one of the first.
Yeah, she obviously bought the ticket behind his back.
That's great.
And then won. And there's a lot of other great stories, but you wouldn't buy the book if I told you all of them.
There you go. Yeah. Well, the book is coming out next year. It's called All of King's Horses: How New Hampshire Fought the Feds, the Mob, the Church, the Media, and itself to start the first lottery. Kevin Flynn, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.